Mainers with intellectual and developmental disabilities, how has the system for them changed and where does it stand today? It's been 22 years since the Pineland Center closed its doors. Pineland was the state institution that used to house many of Maine's residents with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It was shut down after a class action lawsuit in the early 90s cited appalling conditions there. After Pineland closed, Maine instituted a group home system. But now, that system is in crisis as group homes around the state struggle to hire and keep enough staff members to care for their residents. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the situation in Maine for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We'll also learn about organizations and resources to help families navigate the system and care for their loved ones. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio Studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, or IDD, everyday tasks can present challenges. Today we're going to learn about those challenges and how some of them can be alleviated. We'll also hear about what services are available and why Maine is facing a shortage of people who are able to help care for those with IDD. Joining me in our studio, Lydia Dawson. She is Executive Director of the Maine Association for Community Service Providers. Bonnie Jean Brooks is here. She's President and CEO of OHI, which provides supports and services to people with intellectual disabilities, autism, and mental illness. And David Cowing is the father of an adult son with intellectual and other disabilities. He's also a retired special education teacher and administrator and an active member of two grassroots organizations, the Maine Coalition for Housing and Quality Services and Community Connect. As always, we want to hear from you. Does someone you know have IDD? What questions do you have about accessing services? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you. And Bonnie, I'm going to start with you. I understand you've worked in this field for 50 years, and in that time, there has been a sea change in attitudes toward people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Tell me how things have changed since you started with this work.
Well, it's changed from the language that people use when they refer to someone with IDD, to the quality of services that they are receiving. There is certainly a big difference between what they were receiving 50 years ago and what they are receiving now. There's also a change in community attitude about the value that people with IDD bring to our Maine communities. So there have been some significant changes.
Sure, 50 years ago, someone may have been institutionalized, may have been distrusted, thought that they were potentially going to become a criminal, correct?
That's correct. People were afraid of people. They were afraid that they would hurt them. Or there were families at that time who were told that if they institutionalized their loved one, that they should not come back to the institution. And so families feared the repercussions of trying to stay in contact with their son or daughter.
And now a lot of people with IDD have jobs. Some even live on their own, correct?
That is a remarkable thing that has happened in the course of these last 50 years, is to see people who were nonverbal, who were restrained, were put into impossible, traumatic environments, now working, now living on their own, being married, being member of civic organizations. It's just a fantastic change.
David, when we are talking about people with IDD, who are we talking about? People with Down syndrome, with autism?
There's a number of different genetic and other factors that can cause intellectual disability, what we used to call mental retardation. It can arise for somebody who has cerebral palsy or some other situation. Some people can have an acquired neurological problem, like a traumatic brain injury, who have many of the same characteristics of somebody who would have an intellectual disability. But generally, intellectual disability is considered by the state or the federal government as someone who's acquired that disability as a child prior to becoming 21.
And how is it determined? Is it an IQ test or?
That is such a great question, Jennifer, because as someone who's come from a school system experience for many years, schools go through an identifying process to see whether or not someone has a disability as part of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and have IEPs, and you go through a whole evaluation process. And how schools define intellectual disability or autism can be very, very different from the way, as an adult, the state and federal system of supports define what an intellectual disability or autism is. And it's a very, very confusing time for parents when they go from a school system-based support system to an adult-based support system, because those differences and other differences exist.
Okay. I want to get more into that in just a little while, but I want to also bring Lydia into the conversation. What is the law? What are the rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
Well, Maine for a very long time has been a front runner in providing developmental services, so home and community-based services for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities to be able to access the medical support that they need to stay in the community and delay or avoid unnecessary and expensive institutionalization. And right now we have some serious concerns about the rights of people with developmental disabilities in that they can't access that support because it's so vastly underfunded that we have huge wait lists, and frankly, we're unable in the provider community to hold on to staff to be able to continue having homes where people can access 24/7 support, community supports where people can access community integration. There was a bill that was placed in session, last session, that passed through LD 967 to ensure access to community services, which would increase that rate for those services and hopefully avoid this disintegration of developmental services that we've started to see in this last 10 years.
So my understanding is something like 1,000 people on a wait list for a group home. Is that accurate?
There's people over 1,000 that are waiting for services altogether. But even the people that we're serving right now, which is approximately 4,000 people that are receiving services, aren't receiving access to consistent services because the direct care workers that we rely on to provide that one-on-one support or whatever support that the person needs to be able to stay in the community are making just barely above minimum wage. They've experienced over the last decade huge cuts to their wages that back in 2007, we were funding people at just over $10 an hour, which was $3 over the minimum wage at that time. And now we're funded prior to 2017, it was barely above $9 an hour. So you can see how over the last decade, we've really undervalued that work. And because of that, we can't keep staff in homes. And so let's say somebody has access to that funded services and they need 24/7 support in their home or in an agency home. If we can't keep the staff in those homes, people don't get access to the high quality support that they need in the community to stay there. And I think there's a real concern that we would move back into an institutional model or people would be stuck in ERs because they can't access the support that they're entitled to.
I want to ask Bonnie, Lydia's talking about a bill before the legislature, but 22 years ago, what ended Pineland was a lawsuit and a consent decree. You were part of that lawsuit. Could something similar happen today if there remains a waiting list of more than 1,000 people for group homes and support in Maine?
Yes, certainly. We certainly could return to some sort of legal action. I hear about it here in Maine. There's a continuing discussion here in Maine, and it's a growing discussion. I'm seeing it as a national leader in my national organization where there's similar discussion across this country right now in some states that have not had rate increases in many, many years.
All right. David, you wanted to jump in before. Go ahead.
Well, good eyesight there. I wanted to speak at a personal level, some of the things that Lydia was highlighting. My son is in a group home, and over in the last year, there's probably been over a dozen staff in and out of his house. And over the last 5 years, there's been four supervisors in that house. And when we go to Lowe's or we go to Kmart or Walmart or Cumberland Farms, we run into staff that used to be at my son's house. And they'll invariably come up to me or my son and say, oh, we miss you. We're so glad you're to have a chance to see you. We wish we could have afforded to stay at Jay's house because we really thought the work was important and we enjoyed working with your son. But there was just no way that we could afford for our family, for me to be able to stay in the agency. Most of the workers that I'm aware of, the direct support professionals that we call DSPs, work at least two jobs. I know many of them that work three jobs, and most rely on overtime to be able to do the work that they need to do. So even the good staff that we have at my son's house, and I think at a lot of other houses, are just working incredibly hard for very long hours, and that takes a toll on them.
And to put some real numbers on it, we're talking that most DSP is the direct service providers are making $10 an hour. Is that correct? Is that, and they're paid in most cases through Medicaid?
Right. So the Department of Health and Human Services sets the rate for what the wage would be for a DSP. And just in 2017, it was a little over $9 an hour, and LD 967 went before the legislature, and it passed, but it was only partially funded for the first year. And so that partial funding brought us up to approximately $10 an hour, which is, you know, minimum wage now. And so there is a sunset clause in that rate. So on June 30th, if the legislature doesn't set aside any additional appropriation for this bill, we would go back to $9 an hour, which is, well, a little over $9 an hour, which is sub-minimum wage now. And so I think we can all be assured that there would be even more of a staff turnover. Providers would be closing homes. There would be no way to operate if that funding is not secured.
But even if the funding is secured and we're able to continue to pay direct service providers $10 an hour in an economy with a very low unemployment rate, is that going to be enough to keep people employed in group homes? You're shaking your head, Bonnie.
Yes. No, it will not be enough to keep them employed. We have staff now, just as David mentioned, who are leaving to go to jobs that are 8-to-5 jobs in the community, making $2 and $3 more an hour. And if we can't compete with the retail industry and the food service industry, we're going to continue to lose. And we have seen provider agencies close. We've seen provider agencies merge. We see individuals ending up in emergency rooms, as been mentioned, because we cannot pay competitive wages.
And we're really chasing the increase in the statewide minimum wage. And I was at a meeting earlier this week where I was talking with someone who is a service provider in the Portland area, and he brought to my attention the fact that in Portland, we're chasing the raise in minimum wage that Portland has, which is, I think, exceeding the state rate. So it's a moving target that we're trying to reach.
At this point, we're really just trying to stabilize the system. So the bill that's before the legislature and that's up for appropriations this session would put us back to where we were a decade ago, so that a little over $10 an hour we just spoke about, plus 10% for inflation. And then we're very hopeful that the legislature will consider an amendment which puts in a cost of inflation, that we wouldn't continually be coming back with low numbers, and hopefully that there would be an automatic adjustment as inflation goes forward. And since this was a bipartisan effort that was put into place last session, we're really looking to both Democrats and Republicans to keep those assurances they gave us that they will finish the job, and that direct care rate workers are at the top of their list. We're looking to our sponsor, Representative Herbig, and other representatives, Ken Fredette, that gave us those assurances to hold true to that and to fight for us.
Even if this passes, though, does that alleviate the waiting list?
No.
No.
Mm. No, it doesn't, and the waiting list continues to grow. We have children graduating from high school and coming into adult services. Maine is the oldest state in the country and getting older faster than any other state. So we have an increasing number of people who need services who are coming onto that waiting list. And because Maine is an old state, the needs of these individuals are changing. So we are constantly needing to retrain staff for the medical challenges that are coming forward from people who they've supported, some for 30, 35 years.
And at the other end, Jennifer, something that's very apparent to me, having worked in schools, is the acute nature of some of the medical and behavioral needs of the students going through the school system now. A lot of it is much greater than it used to be 10, 20, 30 years ago. So we have very medically fragile kids coming through the school system, transitioning to adult services. We have some real serious mental health and behavioral challenges that come through the system. And if we don't have some kind of safety net for these people once they transition out of high school, frequently it precipitates crises, which precipitate the need for a much more expensive service, so that providing adequate services from the get-go can often be the least expensive option.
Mm. I'm going to go to Joshua, who's calling from Hobson. Hi, Joshua. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. I'm actually calling to speak on behalf of people with disabilities, and I'd like to share a few thoughts. One is I have cerebral palsy. I was incredibly concerned that you guys didn't reach out to somebody that has a disability to get some of the concerns that are going on in the system, and I'm just concerned that nobody reached out to anyone.
Joshua, we have you on the air. What would you like to say to our audience?
I'd like to say that services for people with disabilities, not a lot of people want group home services. People want to be in their own homes. And, you know, it's the most expensive option that Maine has.
You're saying that a group home is the most expensive option?
One of the most expensive options.
Okay, so being in a group home is more expensive than being in your own home. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In fact, they pay shared living providers a whole heck of a lot less. People want to either be on their own and be independent. There is something that the federal government allows, which is called the independence course waiver. The federal government gives the flexibility in creating a self-directed waiver.
Okay.
And under the Section 21 waiver, it is not implemented.
Joshua, Lydia is nodding. She knows what you're talking about. Go ahead, Lydia.
Hey, Josh. I just wanted to say that I do agree that sometimes we talk about these services in terms of group homes and people who are looking for 24/7 support. But you're absolutely right that every service should be individualized to the needs of the person.
Yes, it is not.
Right. It absolutely should be directed by the person, the supports that they need. And I hear you that that you have concerns that sometimes that's not what's happening. And I think we need more advocates like you and people who are speaking up to make sure that supports and services are self-directed and that they're meeting the needs of the people that they're intended to support. And to be clear about the legislation, it would when we talk about LD 967, we're not just talking about group homes. We're not just talking about a 24/7 support model. We're talking about any kind of support that someone needs that's provided by a direct care worker. So that's that community support, that's that in-home support. It's anything that would meet the needs of the person and that's individualized to the person.
Joshua, thank you so much for calling in. We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Natural Resources Council of Maine, hosting a forum on climate change and national security with Senator Angus King. More at nrcm.org. And the University of Maine's Framing Maine series, presenting an evening of song and story with David Mallett, April 7th. Tickets at framingmaine.com.
The migrant caravan that prompted a tweet storm from President Trump earlier this week is stalled in Mexico. Several hundred people have been deported back to Central America, and the fate of the others remains unclear. I'm Audie Cornish. We'll bring you that story plus the latest on the shooting at the YouTube headquarters in San Bruno, California, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30, right here on Maine Public Radio. If you have a voice-activated smart speaker, like an Amazon Echo or a Google Home, they'll be happy to bring you both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical. All you have to do is ask it to play Maine Public Radio, and just like that, without lifting a finger, you'll hear us. It's that easy. More information about how to use your smart speaker to hear Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical is online at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jenna Brooks. Today on the program, intellectual and developmental disabilities and the system in Maine. Joining me today, Bonnie Jean Brooks, who is president and CEO of OHI, which supports people with intellectual disabilities. David Cowing has a son with developmental challenges, and he is active in advocating for support with people of IDD. And Lydia Dawson, who is executive director of the Maine Association for Community Service Providers. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we took a call from Josh, who has cerebral palsy and really wants people to think about other living arrangements than group homes. You feel as though, David, that what Josh is talking about is civil rights for people with mental disabilities.
I really think there's a direct line from the civil rights work that was done in the 50s and 60s for African Americans and persons of color, the women's rights issue that came on the heels of that, and the rights of the disabled currently. And none of those are finished projects. Those are all very much in need of advocacy. I think for those like Josh that can do self-advocacy, there is a frustration that all these other people are talking about what they think Josh or somebody else might need. I know in the case of my son, who has very limited language, and other people I know that are more cognitively impaired as well as language impaired, since they can't really effectively advocate for themselves, it really depends on good service providers, family members, and others to advocate for them.
Bonnie?
It's really interesting that we are talking about civil rights on this day, 50 years ago, from the time that Martin Luther King was shot. 50 years ago, I was teaching in Los Angeles in Watts. And that's when I became really engaged in the civil rights movement. And I've continued to say through all these 50 years, and to my staff, to the new staff who walk through the door, and continue to reiterate to my current staff, that we, in the field we are in the disability field, are engaged in the biggest civil rights movement, perhaps, that this country has ever known.
We'll go to Joseph, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yep.
All right, excellent. First off, David Cowling, are you affiliated with MS-80 75?
I was, yes, at one time before I retired.
Excellent. Okay, well, I just want to say thank you for your work. My mother and my brother interact with you. Brothers of Michael Fournier. I'm sure you know my mother, Susan Fournier, yeah. Anyway.
Michael is a fond memory.
Yes, yes. So thank you, first of all, just thank you for all your work. But secondly, just I'm currently managing a home for CASA, and I just want to talk about the value of the work, how even though you can't, with funding, you don't get the pay that you deserve working as a DSP, the value is just so extraordinary. How you not just learn about others, but you also learn about yourself is unparalleled. It's just incredible, but it does speak to the turnover and the funding that we have, too. I want to encourage everybody just to talk to their representative and push for more funding. When we have, when we're competing with Cumberland Farms and whatnot for pay, it's a little hard because there are some challenging things that you have to put up with in this field and get through and overcome. And there's the funding, the turnover is hard to deal with. If we can get these things resolved, I'm just encouraging people to talk to their representatives as often as they can.
Okay, Joseph, thanks so much for your call. We have some similar emails that I'm going to read through. This one's from Jan. We have a 39-year-old son who has been disabled since birth. His diagnosis is intellectually disabled on the autism spectrum with behavioral challenges, and he has been a resident at John F. Murphy Home since 2000. His direct support professionals are trained, compassionate, and caring people who do not make enough money to think of this calling as long-term employment. She talks about how the agencies have lost funding over the last several years. The staff is underpaid and asks, where will this end up? We are not capable of having our son live at home. He is a large man and we are senior citizens. Why can we not get back to the excellent system that was in place 15 years ago? And then from Kenneth, my wife and I are parents to two children. Our son, Justin, is 22 years old and has Down syndrome. He's a full-time job and needs constant supervision. I work part-time when not acting as a caregiver. Currently, he is underserved. By the state's guidelines, he is due more hours than we can get coverage for. And agreeing with everybody else, it is very important that the state fund these folks who are so critical to our kids' lives. So a lot of agreement from, go ahead, David.
It's a problem that I've been aware of for quite some time as a teacher that worked really hard transitioning students from school-based to adult-based services, where you have two parents both working, which is not untypical these days, and the only choice for that family is for one parent to stop working in order to support a son or a daughter at home, which takes them out of the workforce, reduces the household income, and requires even more expensive and more support for that family. So I really think frequently that doing the right thing and supporting people in the way that they need their supports, no more and no less, but having that system responsive to those needs is not only the right thing to do, but the least expensive thing to do.
Bonnie, how does Maine's system compare to other states?
Well, I would have said 20 years ago that the quality of services and the quantity of services we were offering here in Maine was number one in the country. Very sadly, as I reach toward the end of my career, I can no longer say that. We have been on a downhill slide since the closure of the community consent decree in 2010. And when I talk with my national colleagues, I am embarrassed to compare Maine to some of the other states, unfortunately.
Many of the checks and balances that we had in the system that came out of the community consent decree that were supposed to ensure that people had access to the support that they needed and intervention when they needed it, have really eroded over the last 10 years. And so a couple of things we point to is crisis services are at a third what they were even just a year ago. The access to out-of-home placement for somebody who doesn't have anywhere to go and is in crisis is hugely lacking. It's very hard to get access to crisis support right now. We just had the issuance of the Office of Inspector General report, which found that we weren't reviewing the deaths of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to ensure that there was no suspicious circumstances or wrongdoing. We also had findings that Adult Protective Services wasn't intervening on a consistent basis, and very few of the cases that were reported of abuse, neglect, and exploitation were actually followed up on. So I think there's a great concern while this workforce crisis is looming that people are potentially falling through the cracks, because all of these places that these safeguards we've put in place through the community consent decree since the ending of the community consent decree have since fallen by the wayside.
I want to turn this conversation around just a little bit to you, David. And if someone has a child who has an intellectual or developmental disability, they may be listening to this conversation, especially child in teenage years, soon to age out of the education system, may be listening to this frustrated and worried. But you are a part of organizations designed to help parents and providers and others come together. What advice do you have to a parent who you were in their position 10 years ago?
And it was only through the great good fortune, or if you ask my daughter, maybe it was the misfortune of having two parents that were teachers, that we had the same school schedule, the same snow days, the same time off in the summer, which made caring for my son a lot easier. There was still before and after school.
So if someone wanted to reach out, who can they reach out to?
There's a couple of organizations that I'm a part of. In Portland, or it's Portland-based, there's the Maine Coalition for Housing and Quality Services. They have a website, which I think I've shared, that will be posted on the Maine Public site. MaineCoalition.org, I believe, is what it is. And it's been around for over 10 years. It's headquartered in Portland, and it's an opportunity for parents, care providers, and other people to get together and have chances to collaborate and problem solve and hear what are the needs out there and how can they be addressed. A couple of years ago, what we were able to do is set up satellite sites throughout the state so that people can actually go in remotely to access the meetings that we have in Portland. There's extensive information on the site, past notes and information from our monthly meetings, where the meetings are held on the second Tuesday of every month at noon. You can go to the site, access the notes from those meetings. You can call in remotely. And a lot of the questions that parents or caregivers might have, I think, would be there, and people are ready and willing to help out through these meetings. Another organization is more recent that we've developed, which is Community Connect, and several of us have gotten together to create a system that, rather than being just based in Portland, has a number of different areas of the state where information can be shared and people can get together. It's a very isolating thing to be a mom or dad of somebody with a disability. You really get the feeling that you're the only one out there that has that problem, that has to help your son or daughter go to the bathroom or feed themselves or get them ready for bed. For those who have had young kids, if you can imagine having perhaps a two-year-old over the course of 40 years, with the same sorts of needs, it's very fatiguing, and oftentimes it keeps you at home and keeps you isolated just because you're providing constant care for your son or daughter. The other thing that goes with that, which I see a lot, is a sense of guilt that you're not doing enough, that if only you could do just a little bit more, your son or daughter would do better. What I find to be the case across the board is the last thing that we want as family members is pity. We don't want people feeling sorry for ourselves. We just want the services for our sons or daughters that they deserve and that would help them be a part of their community.
And we'll put information about both of those organizations on the Maine Calling Facebook page and on the Maine Calling webpage, mainecalling.org. We're going to go to Jack in Newburgh. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a 48-year-old son with stage 4 colorectal cancer. He's intellectually disabled and lives in a group home with Down East Horizons, a wonderful organization that takes good care of him. However, I would support all the comments about the burnout and the turnover, and many of those are on overtime, and it just leads to a high turnover rate because of the wages. But what I'd like to visit is the reality of what these staff persons do. For instance, with my son having colorectal cancer, there's been bleeding issues. There's medication to be given, medication issues, and calls to doctors and all transportation demands. There's diet restrictions. There's health monitoring as far as blood pressure and temperature readings and this sort of thing. And so, you know, the wage that we're talking about, even if LD 967 goes through, how can anyone rightfully even argue the point that doing those kinds of things, and I know of others, you know, who have Alzheimer's, others in the system who have cancer and different issues. My son will probably end up with a colostomy and, you know, would be cared for by these folks. So I just wanted to speak to that. And also, you know, it's all budgets are a matter of, in whether it's a family budget or a state budget or a federal budget, it's a matter of priorities. And the most vulnerable, at risk, and needy individuals in our society, there shouldn't be any debate about this, that people who are caring for them get a just wage.
Jack, thanks so much for your call. And a lot of people calling in today agree with you. And good luck to your family. Good luck to your son. We do have to take another quick break. But before we do so, a word about tomorrow's show. We're going to be talking about green building and sustainable homes. So you can email your comments or questions ahead of time if you'd like to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. As do Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org. And Islamic Center of Maine's 9th Annual Open House, Finding Stability in a World Out of Balance, April 7th. IslamicCenterofMaine.org.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Could meditation be an effective antidote to stress and anxiety? This week, we're joined by Bob Roth, a teacher of transcendental meditation, and producer, screenwriter, and director David Lynch. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Stay with us for City Arts and Lectures coming up in about 20 minutes after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air.
Be heard. The world can take.
We talk with Mark Oliver Everett. His band Eels has a new album. Many of his songs are about depression, including songs about his sister who took her life. Eels' record Fresh Blood was the theme for the HBO series The Jinx. Join us.
I'm not gonna let it. Fresh Air later this evening at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, helping those with IDD, intellectual and developmental disabilities. Joining me today, David Cowing. His son has IDD. Lydia Dawson. She's with the Maine Association for Community Service Providers. And Bonnie Jean Brooks, President and CEO of OHI. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have a tweet from Susan. As a parent of an adult child with IDD, transition to adulthood is critical. Obtaining adult services is an uphill battle and would not have been achieved if he was not the son of a disability rights lawyer and speech-language pathologist. Many Mainers do not have the wherewithal to successfully advocate. Such a loss of human potential. My son is now living independently with our oversight and successfully employed with a girlfriend. This was no easy task. So thank you, Susan, for that. We're going to go to Diane, who's calling from Sanford. Diane, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I just wanted to speak a little bit about DSPs. And I've been in this field for almost 20 years. I grew up with a sibling who had disabilities. And I just wanted to say that the work that the DSPs provide, you know, it's challenging work. The parent just ahead of me said, you know, the things that we are providing, from those hygiene things to, you know, assisting with feeding and all of those areas that these individuals aren't able to do themselves, that we're assisting them with, it's important. They require these services, and I just want to say that I love my job. I feel it's extremely important and valuable, you know, and it's rewarding, but it's also very necessary and very undervalued at this time by our state. Up until recently, the agency that I work for, you know, over the past 10 years, there's been so many rate reductions that, you know, it's just caused a hardship. And the recent partial improvement of LD 967 has helped, but it's not enough.
Yeah, Diane, thank you for your call. David, I know you wanted to talk about the quality of services that your son receives.
Just by the luck of the draw, because Jay went through the system at a time when the state was committed to eliminating the waiting list, and there was monies for residential development that aren't available now. We were able to make sure that he was in a group home just down from his high school, across from the library and the YMCA, and be able to be someone who could live and work in his home community. He has what I'm convinced are some of the best staff in the state. I'm probably a little prejudiced, but he has wonderful supports, people who are very invested in him doing well. He works at McDonald's just once a week, but that's about all that he can handle. He has really top-notch medical care that requires that we get him to three different cities and two different states, and so we make lots of trips to Boston. But he's a happy camper. He enjoys his life. It is separate from us as his parents, although we have regular contact on a weekly basis, and we do holiday greetings, holiday get-togethers together, so that we see each other regularly. But it was my son and our experience with him and seeing what he could achieve with high-quality services that really gave me the impetus to think that, you know, he shouldn't be getting that, while some people don't have any services at all, or there are others that have services that are not as high quality just as the result of the way the system works.
Diane, thank you for your call. We're going to go to an email from John. Can any of your guests explain how a house, a private residence, can become a home? What has to happen for somebody's house to get made into a state-run home, i.e. a residential setting for mentally handicapped adults?
Supports and services that are funded under Section 21 and 29 of the Maine Care Benefits Manual are supposed to provide the supports and services that someone needs in order to remain in the community, so that they're not going into an institution or having unnecessary or overly intrusive supports and services. So traditionally, the regulations that govern those supports and services look to enroll someone as a provider so that they can be overseen by the Office of Maine Care Services and ensure that they're following all the licensing regulations and all of the training priorities that were put in place to ensure that we are providing people with appropriate services.
So where would somebody turn if somebody says, I would be interested in turning my home into a home, in quotes, for a group home?
I think, well, you would want to start with the Department of Health and Human Services and go through that provider enrollment process. But I guess I would just like to say that individuals are entitled to whatever support and service that they need. And I think our system has so disintegrated in the last 10 years or so that we've just started trying to make what works with what we have. And we've stopped looking at innovative approaches about the most individualized need that we could have. And the Americans with Disabilities Act is still very much alive, and it says that people are entitled to the supports and services they need in order to stay in the community. And so to the extent that somebody needs something, they need it in their own home or they need it in a specific setting, even if that's not specifically prescribed by regulation and doesn't fit into a specific box, they're still entitled to that support and service. And I think one of the things that we've heard pretty consistently is there being a lack of communication between the state and providers and individuals and families. And I think that's something that about how we can better provide those supports and how we can better integrate those services, because they should be directed by the person and should absolutely meet the needs of the person, not less, not more. And I think that's one of the things we're hopeful, the three of us being here today, is that we're really trying hard to have everyone's voices heard, be opening those lines of communication so that we can stabilize the system that we have, and then look to some of those new approaches Like Josh was talking about earlier, there are other ways to manage programs. But right now we're in such a place of disarray that we're just hoping to stop the bleeding so that we can start that communication about the best way to provide services.
Going to read a couple emails from folks who want to share services. This is from Deb. I would like to share that the Maine Adaptive provides year-round sports programming for adults with children with disabilities. We recently concluded a successful winter season and are currently accepting applications for our summer 2018 program for athletes and volunteers. So that's maineadaptive.org. And then we have an email from Emily. Camp All Sing is a Maine sleepaway camp for kids age 9 to 17 with high-functioning autism and other social communication challenges. We are a totally unique program, and we are right here in Maine. And that's www.campallsing.com, campallsing.com. We'll go to Christina, who is calling from Portland. Hi, Christina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Go ahead.
I've been fortunate enough to graduate from Strive U, which allowed me to transition from my mom's house into my own apartment. I wish there would be more opportunities like that for other people. I hear from other people living in group homes a lot. They would like to be on their own or in a shared living situation.
Christina, thank you so much for calling in. I know that Strive U, which is a really innovative program in Portland, has so many more applicants than it can take, because it is so rare to have a program that helps young adults learn to live on their own. Bonnie, though, is this the future? Programs like Strive U?
I think it could be, but we're going to need the resources to create the future. And at this point, we just need the resources to hold on to what we've got and to be able to fill the openings in our homes that we can't fill now because we can't recruit the staff. And this has become quite a psychological challenge for agency directors like me and for staff who've been employed for a long time in leadership positions. We've made promises and commitments to our communities that we will be there for them, that we will be there for the sons and daughters of our community members. And we are reneging on our commitment. We can't accept people into these openings because we can't find the people to staff the openings. If we can build up the resources that we had during the days of the consent decree, then we certainly can create opportunities like Strive U and other similar opportunities.
Christina, are you still there?
Yes.
Can I ask you what your job is?
I work at Strive Coast Funds.
Terrific. Well, congratulations to you, and I'm really happy that you called in. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to go on to Jody calling from Naples. Hi, Jody. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I just wanted to speak to the experience my daughter and I had a few years ago. We moved to Maine because of the resources they had for her. She had cerebral palsy due to toxoplasmosis. She was physically like a 3 or 4 month old, spoke with her eye gaze until we got her a computer where she used a computer with a head switch. She was going to school mainstreamed in high school at Lake Region, wasn't getting a fair and equal education. If her aides didn't show up, she couldn't go to school, or I'd have to take off work to be her one-on-one. That doesn't suit well with any teenager. But Jennifer wanted to practice civil disobedience so she could get into Crotchet Mountain because the school system had reneged on her funding. And when they reneged, we handcuffed ourselves to the high school doors. She eventually went on to go to Crotchet Mountain, got accepted to Keene State, and went on and got her diploma at Keene State. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. But she has met barriers from day one. When she was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, from healthcare to insurance to education to care in schools, and even as an adult, she met so many obstacles with the medical systems here at Dartmouth, at Keene, because they don't know how to take care of young adults with special needs. And this is a growing concern for many of our families. But I wanted to also say I can't unfortunately speak to Maine's, but New Hampshire Institute of Disability, their leadership program is an amazing thing to teach you how to become a great advocate for yourself and your family members.
Jody, Bonnie is nodding as you say that. I thank you so much for your call, and I'm sorry for everything your family went through. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Lisa calling from Bodenham. Lisa, we're tight on time, so if you could be quick, that'd be wonderful.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about what it was like to be a parent with an adult with disabilities who is on that wait list. As far as I know, there are 1,555 people on that wait list for Section 21. And the terror that parents live with. I have a younger daughter, too, who is a freshman in college. If, you know, you as a parent, you work your whole life to make your kids independent of you. And my younger daughter would be fine if anything happened to me and my husband. But we're both the youngest siblings in our family. And in theory, when we die, there is nobody to take care of our older daughter. And that is a terrifying thought. She can't, you know, she's fairly high functioning. She cannot survive on her own. And if, you know, one of the previous callers said it's just a matter of priorities. And that's absolutely right.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your call, and good luck to your daughter and your family. You will be the last call of the hour. We're out of time. I want to thank my guests here in the studio with me, Lydia Dawson, Executive Director of the Maine Association for Community Service Providers, Bonnie Jean Brooks, President and CEO of OHI, providing support and services to people with IDD, and David Cowing, a parent of an adult son with developmental, physical, and mental health challenges, and a founding member of Community Connect. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, green buildings and sustainable homes. And for those of you looking for a really cool video to watch, Maine Public's own Brian Bouchard has put together some drone footage for a new visual series called From Above, which will capture some of the beauty of Maine's towns from the air. The first in the series is Bridgeton. Visit our Facebook page or the Maine Public website to have a look. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.